bleeding in case of attack. Use duct tape to stem bleeding. Cut out the carpet if needed to wrap any injured personnel. Drag them out. The buildings were magnificent, monumental, Jay says. In person, he cuts a tidy figure. His sandy hair and mustache are carefully trimmed. And when I visit him in Maryland, his memories of Iraq are as precisely rendered as his facial hair. Everything in the palace, even though lots of artifacts had been torn out before we got there, all the details were of the highest quality. The millwork, the lavatories, even the door hinges. The spaces were enormous. On the scale of the Library of Congress, marble everything, chandeliers everywhere. Jay split his time between the Public Affairs Office and the Cultural Affairs section, located in another, smaller palace about 2 miles away. People called that one the Little Palace. It, too, had a pool, supposedly put in by Hussein's sons. To cover ground between the two palaces, Jay rode a green Montague paratrooper folding bike, the same model that airborne soldiers used in Afghanistan. They could drop from a helicopter with it and ride off as soon as they landed. He didn't bother to wear a helmet. Swimming has always been a means of escape, physical, spiritual, mental. And if that's true, then what better place is there for a swim team than a war zone? Everyone had friends blown up and their own close calls. Near-death experiences are the kind of thing that knits you together. Get in a pool together afterward and, in the delayed reaction realization that you're still alive, exuberance bubbles to the surface. The desert dust would create these gorgeous sunsets. The human instinct when you see one is to stop and look. Jay recalls of that time. But what made it eerie in Baghdad is that it's also a wonderful time to mortar, because it means that when the U.S. attack helicopters go looking for you, it's a little bit dusty, so they can't see you as well. So when it was an especially beautiful sunset, you could expect that mortars would fall. That's the screwed-up logic of a combat zone. Coach Jay began leading drills in the palace pool with Andre from Madagascar and Valya from Bulgaria, helping Andre to slow his frenetic windmill down and Valya to escape the tyranny of her archaic strokes. 10 months into Jay's stay, the entire U.S. community in the Green Zone moved from Hussein's palace into the just-completed and impressively fortified new embassy compound. The decision had been made to give the palace and the Green Zone back to the Iraqis. The hope was that both the palace and its pool would eventually be used by ordinary citizens. Though the move meant leaving the lavish pool behind, Jay found that the new facility had a 25-yard indoor lap pool open 24 hours a day. It was then that the swimming lessons began in earnest. In the space of 2 weeks, Coach Jay's swimming students tripled, then doubled again from 4 pupils to 12, then 24. Then they tripled and doubled some more. Andre and Valya brought their friends, and their friends brought their friends. Most were beginners, their skills raggedy but existent. The back wall of the new pool was mostly glass, and outside, a Baghdad modern version of the broad pedestrian esplanade connected housing blocks and offices to the gym and dining hall. From the walkway, you could see people swimming. I guess we couldn't have asked for better advertising, says Jay. Andre worked in the cultural affairs section too, assisting Jay with the Fulbright and other academic and professional exchange programs. The two men put up a few announcements around the Green Zone about the lessons, which were held 3 days a week, with morning and afternoon sessions. A couple of months into the swimming experiment, Jay and Andre found themselves sitting in the office more than a little stunned at the overwhelming response to the lessons and wondering just what it was they'd started. The swim team was an all-volunteer effort on their part, organized in addition to their normal job duties. But as more swimmers joined, they felt compelled to hold enough classes to keep up with the numbers. A new group of students appeared, people who had never before been in the water. A few of the Muslim women had never worn swimsuits in public. They told Jay that they'd never had the chance to do any sport except bowling. They arrived clutching Land's End catalogs and asked him what swimsuits to buy. Absent first-hand experience in the matter, Jay quickly referred all fashion questions to Indrani, his Bengali friend and colleague in the cultural affairs section, who helped each first-timer with the selection of a conservative two-piece or Speedo tank suit. Jay gave every swimmer a number. In the earliest days, Valya was swimmer number one, Andre was number two. Every new swimmer was assigned a buddy already in the swim class. Everybody, even if experienced, would start off the same way, splashing water on their faces, blowing bubbles, pushing off the wall in a streamlined Superman pose. It built a culture of egalitarianism. It meant that someone who 3 weeks earlier was a beginner could then be in the position of teacher. Jay would be on deck, or in the water, offering instruction. Andre, who quickly rose to deputy coach status, would do the same. They played games to keep it entertaining. Jay taught life-saving and got inventive with his lesson plans. He loved old movies, and even old movies could form the basis for drills. We'd play Guns of Navarone, you know, after that 1961 war movie with Gregory Peck, he tells me. He'd have all the swimmers swim soundlessly, mostly submerged, with just their eyes above the water. Then he'd kill the lights at the pool, and he and Andre would bop swimmers on the head with volleyballs if their heads rose too high out of the water. Guns of Navarone, in a war zone. There was a dark humor in that. They could not stop laughing. He's still laughing. Once, a burly South African security specialist asked if he could bring his training dog, a sleek, muscular Rhodesian Ridgeback, to attend swim practice with him. Jay was sorry to have to tell him that no pets were allowed in the pool. Still, they came. A new shuttle bus route was launched to more conveniently transport personnel from the little palace to the pool. Two or three dozen swimmers regularly attended each session, and now military swimmers started to show up. Some were young Marines looking for stroke refinements. Others were career military men and women in their 30s and 40s who would soon be completing their service and wanted to take advantage of their hard-earned fitness by competing in triathlons in civilian life. Though his swimmers' stamina and abilities varied, Jay had pointers for them all. It began to dawn on him that as much as he liked swimming itself, it was the teaching he enjoyed most. Jay ordered grab bags of equipment to outfit his swimmers. Caps, goggles, kickboards. He'd always loved the creative tools and tricks that went along with teaching someone to swim. The ping pong balls that you could blow across the water to encourage a relaxed, focused breathing rhythm. Or the pull buoys that let you feel the tick-tock motion of your hips as they rotated in the water. Some of the swimmers, like the security guards from Peru or Nepal, they were so poor. They lived a hard life and sent all of their money home, Jay says. The fact that someone would give them a cap or a $2 pair of goggles meant a lot. He paid for the gear out of his own pocket. The swim team as we know it in America has its roots in England, where swimming emerged as a collective sport in the early 1800s. Though a seaside culture had developed in the previous century, it centered mostly on bathing and swimming for hygiene and health, not for competition. The first municipal pool in England, the St. George's Baths, opened in Liverpool in 1828, and a slew of others followed. Early swimming clubs began to form at private boarding schools, including Eton College. The school-age boys there kept records of group swimming adventures in Scottish lochs and English rivers. By the early 1840s, the college itself had a swimming requirement and kept a registry of those who did and did not pass the swimming test. Such a pioneer was Eton in English swimming that a few decades later, the college's swimming teacher would publish an illustrated, gilt-edged handbook called The Art of Swimming in the Eton Style. The most significant swimming club of the era was the National Swimming Society, founded in London by a wine merchant named John Strachan. In the 1830s, the NSS hailed the salutary benefits of swimming and organized races in the Serpentine and the Thames Rivers to inspire the public. In one race, the prizes were silver cups and snuff boxes. How very English. The NSS eventually gave out silver medals to other local swimming societies that were being formed at the time, in Oxford, in Glasgow, to use as prizes in their own races. Its members also provided free lessons, but only to the male public. It was not until 1859, with the advocacy of the influential writer and social essayist Harriet Martineau, that select hours and days were set aside for female swimmers at public swimming baths. English women have four limbs, and live in an island, and make voyages, and practice sea bathing, and need exercise in the water at school and at home, and go out in boats. In short, run the universal risks in regard to water, Martineau wrote, with a somewhat wry tone, in an 1861 book of essays. Because of this, she asked, don't they have a claim to be taught to swim just as men do? The girlhood struggle with the physical modesty was no small thing in the Victorian era, and Martineau was concerned with the negative influence of gender on one's state of health. At the time, a few swimming schools were opening up in England for women, but Martineau had a firm universal prescription: swimming lessons for all children from a young age. She had observed girls learning to swim at a Parisian public bath moored in the Seine, all made possible with head-to-toe clothing, waist belts attached to a rope, and male, gasp, instructors. She wanted the same opportunities for English girls. Martineau was up against more than a few stubborn taboos when it came to girls swimming. Remember that the centuries-old practice of swimming a witch, or throwing a suspected witch into the water while bound. If she sank and drowned, she was innocent. If she floated, she was proved guilty, was not unheard of in 19th-century England. But Martineau persisted. In most countries in the world, actually over the greater part of the inhabited globe, the children swim as soon as they walk, if not earlier, Martineau observed. From Egypt to Mongolia to indigenous America and Polynesia, she wrote, the human being is amphibious. There it is again, the ideal of amphibiousness described as a desirable state for, well, everyone the world over. In 19th century England, though, swimming traditions were just getting started, as hundreds of clubs across the country took up the cause of promoting swimming. Some of these still exist today. The Serpentine Swimming Club, founded in 1864, the Otter Swimming Club, 1869. The numbers of casual recreational swimmers increased as municipal pools opened all over England. In August 1875, one of the world's first international swimming heroes emerged, Matthew Webb, a British steamship captain, made the first successful swimming crossing of the English Channel. The distance between England and France is 21 miles at its shortest, though Webb's zigzag course made it nearly double that. His genial, mustached face ended up on matchbooks. 8 years later, in Canada, Webb attempted to swim across the Niagara River at the foot of Niagara Falls and drowned in a whirlpool. But the fever had caught. By 1890, amateur swimming federations had formed in England, Germany, and France. Around the world, what began as fishing and foraging traditions and communal bathing customs evolved, in their own circuitous fashion, to formalized clubs where people could learn to swim. Mostly, they were places to practice the sport together. Harriet Martineau, it would seem, had her way after all. When it comes to practice and participation, the most popular sport in England today is swimming. In my research into early swim lessons, I came across a vintage black-and-white photo taken in September 1906. It shows two tiny tow-headed children suspended in the Thames River from what are essentially oversized wooden fishing poles tied with rope. The poles are held aloft by two male teachers, bent over and arms tensed, frozen by the camera mid-instruction. In the background, a flotilla of rowboats conveys fully clothed adults, parents, passers-by, all with hats and one with a parasol, in safe and distant observation of the lessons. As I examined the scene, the only bit that resisted stillness, that seemed to me kinetic in some ineffable way, was the space occupied by an older, round-faced child who bobs in the water between the small children in the foreground and the boats in the background. That child, I thought, is the end result of these lessons and labors on full display, grinning, untethered, and swimming free. Every year, 372,000 people die from drowning. That's more than 40 people every hour, every day. In 2014, the World Health Organization released a global report on drowning to launch the first worldwide strategic prevention effort. Their goal? To target drowning as a public health challenge. Just because you know how to swim, of course, doesn't mean you won't drown. There are all kinds of factors that contribute to drowning incidents. For example, there is some research that shows parents are less attentive to their young children in the water when those children have had swimming instruction. But the vast majority of drownings happen in low- and middle-income countries where people have close, daily contact with water, among fishermen, say, or farmers ferrying their goods by river, or children fetching water from a well or pond. Even in places with a strong swimming lineage, swim instruction is lacking. In Thailand, for example, where the encroachment of modern life has severely eroded the ability of Mokin Sea nomads to continue their centuries-old nomadic diving and fishing traditions, the World Health Organization in recent years has had to establish structured swimming programs to boost swimming skills in younger generations. Similarly, in Madagascar, an island nation off the southeast coast of Africa, swimming is a luxury. Andre Rambolamanana's family did not have money. But when Andre was a boy, his aunt asked his mother if she could bring him to a swimming course held at a private Catholic school. At the class, the instructor lined all the children up at the side of the pool. Then he told them, one by one, to jump in. "I will never forget him," Andre tells me, "because the experience was horrible. Our first time, to jump. We did not know how to swim at all, but the teacher told us that if we did not do it, he would come for us." Trembling and near tears, 6-year-old Andre stood at the edge, unable to will himself to get in the water. The instructor came up, grabbed him, and jumped in while clutching Andre. There was a whirl of bubbles and tears and terror. Andre doesn't remember much after that. "I don't even know how I got out of the water," he says. "But I did not get back in." Andre, the shivering child, grew into Andre the big athletic man. With massive shoulders and curly dark hair, Andre cuts an imposing physical presence. When we video chat, he is in Paris, where he now lives, and I am in San Francisco. He fills the frame with his bubbly cheer and wide grin. As he shares the story of his first experience with water, though, he seems to shrink into himself, retreating somewhere in his memory. But it is critical backstory to his experience in Baghdad. The best way he can tell me about swimming is to describe what it was to him since he was a child. A scary thing. He was gifted on land. At university, in Antananarivo, the capital of Madagascar, Andre was fond of all sports. In addition to being a kickboxer, he played basketball and took classes with a friend who was a taekwondo master. On Wednesday afternoons, the university offered students free use of its athletic facilities, and that's when Andre reacquainted himself with his old nemesis, the pool. After so many years, he told himself sternly, "I must learn swimming." Andre began going to the pool without instruction, doing his own thing, splashing like crazy. After some days or weeks of patient trial and error, he was able to go the whole length of the pool. "But it was very exhausting because I'm making all my effort to get movement," he tells me, eyes wide. His shoulders quake. He pantomimes his flailing stroke and laughs a deep bass tone at himself. That's precisely the level of swimming experience he brought to Baghdad when he arrived in late 2007, a few months before Jay did. When Andre laid eyes on Hussein's palace pool, he was dazzled. By that time, the army and security guys working in Baghdad were familiar with the opulence and acted accordingly, meaning they thumbed their noses at it. They did cannonballs and strutted around. They kind of felt like they owned the place, Andre says. But he had reverence. For me, I couldn't believe it. We can swim here? Andre first met Jay at work. As a sponsor for newcomers, he was the first to show Jay around the green zone, driving him back and forth in a golf cart. He was there by the trailers on Jay's third day when Jay and JP got blown up. Every night, around 9 or 10 p.m., Andre tried to get to the pool. Jay would already be there, doing his laps. Andre would start his inelegant windmilling. "I didn't know he was observing me," Andre says. And then one evening he said, "What the heck are you doing?" He laughs at the memory. "I really just wanted to go to the end of the lane." Jay demonstrated the little things that he showed to all his beginning swimmers. Try blowing bubbles. Get comfortable with your head in the water. Practice floating while still, then floating with a small kick. Andre did as Jay said, and he felt the difference immediately. "It became easier. The flow was more natural," Andre says. "And that's how it started." Little by little, Andre made improvements. He developed flexibility to go with his strength. For the first time, he could do a lap without being exhausted. With Jay coaxing him to keep going, he swam three more without even realizing it. Andre learned all four competition strokes within 6 months. On his 34th birthday, he swam 34 lengths nonstop. Soon, Jay had Andre coaching the military swimmers, too. Andre had his doubts. "What am I going to do with these guys? They're so much better than I am." But he followed Jay's level-headed example. He wrote up a plan of exercises for the advanced group, ran the swimmers through their drills, and observed them carefully. He tried to emulate Jay. As more swimmers came, Andre saw that Jay's real talent was in giving confidence to whoever showed up. There were people who had never been in the water. There were people who were afraid to put their faces in. There were people who couldn't complete a lap. All those kinds of fears could be conquered. This is how you do it. Play with the water. Blow bubbles. Be like Superman. "And that's what I did," Andre tells me. "I passed along that knowledge." One day, both men were driving through the last checkpoint before the Little Palace when there was a direct hit on the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, compound next door. The sirens went off. The big voice, "Take cover!" warnings blared. And the mortar started dropping, all terrifyingly close. Jay and Andre exited their cars and ran for cover. Andre managed to get inside but lost track of Jay. He began to panic. The resounding booms continued, but still he did not see Jay anywhere and could not reach him on the phone. As soon as the attacks lessened in ferocity, Andre came tearing out of the building to look for Jay. He found his friend. One blast had sent Jay skittering down the lane into a cement wall, a little stunned, but in one piece, and dragged him inside. As Andre talks about Jay and the time they shared in Baghdad, something snags in his voice. His eyes grow damp, his words deliberate. Coach Jay showed Andre Rambolamanana that the impossible was possible. "I never told him this," Andre says, "but I think of Coach Jay as my dad. He is my mentor in every way." 10. Chaos and Order. Most people came to Baghdad on one-year assignments. A swimmer might be with the team for a couple of months, say, before cycling out, but then someone else would join. Over the 2 years that Coach Jay was stationed in Baghdad, his swimming roster grew to more than 200 people. Certain swimmers stood out, like the irrepressible force of nature that was J.P. Santana, a lively, squarely built man with a defiant streak. J.P. lost the lower part of his right arm from grabbing a high-voltage power line as a teenager. Though he learned to swim as a child, he was left with burn scars all over his body. "I was shy about getting back in the pool after that. Afraid, really," J.P. says. "I'd forgotten how to swim, so I was first in line when Jay opened the classes." His right shoulder muscles, scarred and less flexible than his left, made him wonder if he could get back to swimming at all. "Once I hit the pool, I started to swim desperately, afraid I would go straight to the bottom," he remembers. "What I learned with Jay is that I need to find that balance, in swimming and in life." During the month of April in 2008, the surge in U.S. military activity, the new embassy compound was not yet open. When things got hairy during a sustained period of shelling, the cultural affairs staff, including JP and Jay, had to sleep in the office, which provided more hard shell protection than the flimsy tin can residence trailers. We were without water for half a week. Food was the same every day, and an Iraqi friend told me, "Now you see how it is for the middle class in Iraq," JP remembers. But we were lucky. Our only concerns were, don't get killed by a rocket, clean yourself with a handkerchief, and eat the same meal for a week. Compared to what the troops are facing in the field, or Iraqis in their everyday lives, he adds, we were blessed. Being allowed back into their personal trailers was like being let out of prison. Being in the pool, then, felt like nothing short of exhilaration. Balance, JP had told me, in swimming and life. The grim, weighty strictures of war make one long for a little levity. Jay himself was especially struck by the young soldiers who came in droves to the pool. Whether they were enlisted in official military service or under security contract, it was a different population of the world than he'd known in the past. These were very hard young guys, accustomed to going on 18-hour missions, Jay says. They'd come back to Camp Victory, the home base for all those combat, urban patrolled, and sniper detail Marines, smelling of cordite, and they'd prop their weapons up. What do you think was their favorite can't-miss TV program? He asks me. Gilmore Girls, of course. After swim practice, the military swimmers would get back into uniform. In a complicated place that was so reliant on hierarchy and social order, Jay began to think hard about the way that swimming stripped people down to their bare elements. You lose even more of your normal identity than if you got dressed for tennis, for example. You're just skin, cap, goggles, he says. The outfits for swimming are at the bare minimum. Their other identities aren't visible. With two military people, you can't tell who's the officer and who's the enlisted man. That was a bigger deal than he'd realized. He'd thought in particular of the impoverished Peruvian guards, hired by the thousands to bring security and safety to American embassies and combat zones. For them to shed that and come learn swimming, just like the Americans and the other foreigners they guard day in and day out, to have that same privilege, it meant something. Listening to Jay and Andre and JP gives me a sense of what swim lessons in international waters can do. Nowhere else was there such a mingling of soldiers, diplomats, Iraqis, and other nationalities, Coach Jay says of the pool and his swimmers. Differences fell away in the water. Chaos turned to order. I remember what Kim told me about being stripped down to our essential selves in the water and how it allows us to see each other in the most basic way. In the far-flung landscape of the embassy compound, the pool and the lessons in it had the focal power of a call to prayer. It was a way to recognize humanity in a place of deep inhumanity through a kind of communion. By the middle of Jay's stay in Baghdad, many Iraqis had stopped working in the Green Zone because it had become dangerous to be affiliated with the American military, USAID, or the embassy. Suspicion and misunderstanding came from every front. Were you a spy? Were you making a suspicious amount of money? Were you going to abandon Iraq and your family and traditions for America? There was and continues to be the problem of integration. But some Iraqi staff remained at USAID, and they rode the shuttle over to the pool to take swim lessons. Being in the pool was an opportunity to not get singled out for attention, be it positive or negative. They could swim and learn just like everyone else. It was a profound thing. An altering of perspective, of possibility, of who you could be in the world. As I learn more about the Baghdad swimmers, I start noticing how the water is a privileged space, and what an invitation to that space can mean for all kinds of tribes. I watch documentaries about transgender swimmers and autistic swimmers, and how swimming pools mean freedom for their bodies, their minds. Entry into that water can feel like a restoration of power. A serene power, one swimmer says, in the documentary The Swimming Club, about a transgender swimming group in London. And for autistic swimmers, who finally have a team, the Jersey Hammerheads of Perth Amboy, New Jersey, that allows them to compete with everyone else, I see how swimming gives confidence through community. As Jay sees it, His greatest achievement in Baghdad was providing his motley crew the rare opportunity to be together, all in the same pool. Not that there weren't issues. There was one man who spent his time with goggles on looking at women underwater, and several other men who came and sat at the edge of the pool, spectating. But Jay dispatched them firmly. If you come, you have to swim, and we don't take kindly to oglers. He had Andri's bulk, plus the looming presence of a couple of combat servicemen to back him up. To organize the Baghdad swimmers and smooth their social frictions, Coach Jay drew on his experience as a swim instructor in Baltimore, but also on his life's work as a cultural liaison in Africa and the Middle East. Talking about conflicts reminds Jay of his time serving in Cairo, when representatives of different countries struggled to get through Arab League meetings. There was one that ended in a food fight. In Baghdad, at least nobody accused each other of peeing in the pool, he notes dryly, even though they might have thought it. In Andri's case, something that started out as play surprised him by becoming an essential escape hatch to somewhere else. It's like reading books. When you're in it, you're not in the world outside, he tells me. For someone who had never before experienced war, being able to disappear was critical to his well-being. When people ask me about Madagascar, I tell them we don't know war, he says with a light laugh. We don't know what that is. Even back in the time when the French came to take the country, we just gave it to them. It's a joke, but we honestly don't have that kind of feeling of conflict as much as other countries do. In the world of wartime, unpredictable, unstable, and fickle, the pool, the lessons, and the team provided stabilizing ballast. Coach Jay left Baghdad in 2010, and Andri soon followed. Someone from the military side tried to pick up the lessons, but he made it no fun, as I understand it, Jay says. The swimming lessons lasted a month or so after that and never began again. Today, the Baghdad swim team has scattered. Jay still works on cultural exchange programs and Middle East issues. He's busy building a boat in his garage, a 13-foot Jimmy skiff with an outboard, nice for waters there and in Maine. He still swims at his neighborhood pool, just 300 yards from his house outside Baltimore. Andri lives with his wife and toddler son in Paris, in the 15th arrondissement. Recently, Jay took his daughter, Lizzie, to France for a visit. They sought out the city's historic municipal pools built in the 1930s. Andri still has a locker full of goggles and swimming equipment from Baghdad. Jay says that when Andri is ready, he will have all he needs to teach his little boy how to swim. And in Juarez, Mexico, J.P. Santana is still swimming 2 or 3 times a week. The pool is one of his best memories from a tough time. To me, the swimming classes were like an accent of joy, he says. We border people say, la cherry en el pastel, the cherry on top of the cake, or as an Iraqi friend would say, the lamb's head at the top of the biryani. Not long ago, I zoomed around Baghdad using Google Earth and lingered on the bird's-eye views of the Republican Palace and its once-glorious pool, shaded by lush palm trees. It's drained of water now, as dry as the surrounding desert sand, but you can still see the shady perches along the edge of the pool where, once upon a time, a group of lonely swimmers paused for breath and found each other. Competition. There is no passion in nature so demonically impatient as that of him who, shuddering on the edge of a precipice, thus meditates a plunge. Edgar Allan Poe, The Imp of the Perverse. I think of salmon as the ultimate swimmer. Salmon fry, 5 to 10 weeks old and swimming. It's a caption I discovered on an illustration diagramming the salmon life cycle, and it unexpectedly moved me. Fish, of course, are born to swim. It's what they do. But there is a beautiful struggle in the life cycle of the salmon in particular, and a compelling analogy for the human struggle to swim at all. For the salmon, it starts as early as 5 weeks of age, the tiny fish still vulnerable as they wend their way downstream to the ocean. They are hiding under rocks and at the same time hunting for nymphs and insect larvae on which to feed. The salmon life cycle is nothing short of miraculous, an elegant example of the self-sufficiency and persistence. In other words, survival. A salmon begins life in a river, as a freshwater fish. Eventually, the fish smolts, changing its physiology to adapt to salt water, and swims out to the open ocean to spend its adult life. We don't know exactly where a salmon roams during the ocean phase. The different species of salmon in California distribute expansively over the North Pacific and the Bering Sea. But this is where a salmon grows and explores, spending up to 8 years in the open sea, and then it returns to the fresh water from which it came. It's easy to see why the Aboriginal people along the northwest coast of North America hold the salmon in high regard in their mythology. In these cultures, the fish symbolizes instinct and determination and renewal. Here, the salmon is also a primary food source. Here, the life cycle of the human is dependent upon the life cycle of the salmon. When a salmon is ready to return to the freshwater river of its birth, it is transformed again. Depending on species and sex, it will grow a hump or canine teeth, or it will develop a hooked nose, a bit like a prize fighter in preparation for asserting its dominance. Some change color, from a pale silvery blue to a deep red. Eventually, the fish navigates its way back to the mouth of that very same natal river. Once it reaches fresh water, it stops eating. It becomes, by virtue of environment, something else, with the singular goal of muscling its way upstream to the place where it was born. Only the strongest and the fittest can make it to the upper reaches of that river, where it spawns and usually dies, leaving behind its body to enrich the waters. And so life begins again. The salmon is a handy symbol for human aquatic strivings. For me, the story of swimming is also one of adaptation. We work to inhabit this element. Some of us also alter our bodies in pursuit of a goal. For most of us today, apart from the Guthlaugers of the world, that is, survival as motivation, though, has given way to sport. Competition is how we can experience the adventure of assessing and moving through an attractive but decidedly inhospitable environment. It is only with sustained effort that we can master it. For human swimmers, what is competition? It's hard to know where we draw the lines around a contest for swimming supremacy because we can define it in terms of all kinds of superlatives: longest, coldest, deepest, fastest. Swimming is a useful skill with which to fish, yes, but also to fight. We can learn something of the nature of swimming competition from its origins as a wartime art. The ability was held in high regard in ancient civilizations, from the Egyptians to the Greeks. To be ignorant of either letters or swimming, Plato declared, was to lack a proper education. Herodotus described the Greeks as expert swimmers, and thus able to make their escape to shore when their ships were destroyed in battle with the Persians. By contrast, he proclaimed, almost gleefully, great numbers of the barbarians, from their ignorance of this art, were drowned. Escape a sinking ship. Cross a stream. Flee your enemy. Swimming's great value as a martial art since time immemorial is clear. Bas-relief artworks dating to 880 BC show an Assyrian king leading his army across a river with warriors swimming head up on what are thought to be inflated animal skins. In the Roman Empire, youth military training included bathing and swimming in the Tiber River. Julius Caesar was described with much admiration as a gifted waterman. In his biographical account of Caesar, the Greek historian Plutarch wrote of the general at the Battle of Alexandria during the winter of 48 BC, escaping the Egyptians by leaping into the sea and swimming, belongings in one hand, stroking furiously with the other, to the shelter of a ship. Swimming would prove key in later military campaigns, as in the Roman conquest of Britain in AD 69. What was once praised as a military art eventually became celebrated as an athletic art, performed in honor of the gods or ancestors, and finally, in pure contest for its own sake. In the same way that firing a pistol can be repurposed to signal the start of a race, the ferocious drive of battle could now be directed towards sporting competition. Open water swimmers like Kim Chambers, Lynn Cox, and Lewis Pugh can also serve as a kind of bridge to help us understand how endurance and exploration in swimming can be reframed in the context of competition. There has never been a shortage of attempts to swim some tumultuous body of water, often resulting in death or near to it. One July morning in 2007, Pugh stood on the edge of the Arctic sea ice and thought of his mother. She was right. What he was about to do was not normal. Just as he was poised to become the first person to swim across the geographic North Pole, he froze. Not from cold, even though the sub-zero temperatures, negative 1.8 degrees Celsius or 29 degrees Fahrenheit, would make it among the coldest waters any human had ever swum in, but from a creeping existential fear. One shouldn't be able to swim at the North Pole in the first place, he thought. Still he leapt, wearing just his Speedo. In 2003, when Pugh quit his job as a maritime lawyer and set out to be a pioneer open water swimmer, he had a vision of swimming down fjords and around wild capes and past icebergs where nobody else had ever dreamed of swimming before. Like an aquatic Shackleton, he says with a laugh, one evening via video chat with me from his home in Cape Town, South Africa. In my mind, it was a race between the three of us, me, Martin Strell, and Lynn Cox. They started before me, and they took all the bloody warm stuff, so I was left with the cold stuff. This, of course, is tongue-in-cheek. By the time Pugh started, Cox had been pushing the limits of human endurance and setting world records in cold water swims around the world for decades. Cox tells me that she doesn't see herself as being in a race with anyone. Her swims, she says, have always been about human ability and adventure. Despite her resistance to that portrayal, most of us are not immune to thinking about the world in terms of records, and the way we talk about open water swimming achievements reflects this. Though Pugh himself claims that he doesn't compete in the traditional sense, he admits that he is a highly competitive person. In recent years, he has channeled those impulses in a different direction, using the superlatives that define an explorer, best, greatest, first, to his advantage. Being first is everything, Pugh tells me. By this he means that to win support for his cause, he must be first. Being the best, the first, in cold water swims is a means to an end. It is his way to get people to pay attention, to give a sea-level view of our planet in climate crisis. The symbolism of the North Pole swim was clear, that he could swim across a place that you shouldn't be able to swim across, that used to be frozen. His 2015 swim in Antarctica's Ross Sea, in paralyzingly cold waters and severe wind chill, led to meetings with Russian ministers that helped remove the nation's remaining resistance to the establishment of the largest marine protected area in the world. For me, Pugh says, raising his eyebrows for emphasis, it's a competition in creativity. He motions toward his dining room, where the table is covered with a sprawling open atlas, its oversized pages spelling possibility to anyone who knows how to recognize it. For most of us, though, competition is about speed. It's the chase framed by a pool in controlled conditions with regulation attire. It is swimming competition the way it is conducted in the Olympics, for which the metric has always been the clock, how fast you can go. 11. The Splash and Dash. There is no faster event in Olympic swimming than the 50-meter freestyle. Its nickname is the Splash and Dash. One length of the pool, on just the one breath with which you dive. Many world-class swimmers in this event don't take another breath in the 20 to 24-second duration because it would slow them down. There's no time to overthink this race. The objective couldn't be simpler. Get from one end of the pool to the other as fast as possible. As a child, Dara Torres always had to be first, racing her siblings to the dinner table, to the car, to call their mother on her birthday. When Torres was 41 years old, she had already retired from swimming 3 times. But those retirements didn't stick. Competition, she tells me by phone from her home in Massachusetts, is ingrained in her very being. Her 3rd swimming comeback brought her to her 5th Olympics in Beijing in 2008. The first American swimmer ever to compete in that many games. At 41, she was the oldest Olympic swimmer in history. For context, one of her teammates in Beijing was Michael Phelps, who was 23 at the time. Torres won the first gold medal of her Olympic career in 1984, the year before Phelps was born. But she wasn't in Beijing to set age records. She was there to win. Her extraordinary comeback brought her to the final of the 50-meter freestyle, for which she qualified with the fastest time, ahead of women less than half her age. Kate Campbell of Australia, who would go on to win the bronze medal in the event, was just 16 years old. Torres's 2-year-old daughter, Tessa, was home in Florida. "Someday, this is the race my daughter will watch to know who I am," Torres thought. Thanks to her speedy qualifying time, she earned coveted placement in the final. Lane 4, one of the 2 middle lanes, with the best vantage point of her competitors on either side and shielded by them from the slosh of the gutter. In the sprintiest of sprint events, youth is an advantage. Fast twitch muscle fibers, which supply the power for the quick response starting dive, the all-out, breathless, controlled chaos of the arm stroke, the robust motor of the flutter kick, and the propulsive through-the-wall finish that's required to win, decrease rapidly past age 25. Slow twitch muscle fibers, which govern endurance, stick around a little longer. The current male and female world record holders in the 50-meter freestyle were 22 and 23 years old, respectively, when they set their records. It's a race where 1st and 4th are separated by mere hundredths of a second. When it comes to swimming, the competition part has always unnerved me. I don't like it all that much, and I still can't quite make sense of it, so I admit it's hard to write about. Thinking about racing makes me feel queasy. Even when I was a kid, contemplating a race would send me to the bathroom more than once during a single meet, my intestines in revolt, fight or flight. I liked winning, and I liked swimming fast, but I couldn't figure out how to control all the other stuff that went along with getting your body into the revved-up state required to slay your rivals. It's in the interest of understanding this inner drive that I seek out Dara Torres. "Here is a woman so competitive that she floors it at the green light," she confesses to me, "so other cars can't get in front of her. I'm trying to be better with driving fast, since I have kids and all." Here is a woman so competitive that for the longest time she didn't care to swim unless she was winning. The nerves and the gut in revolt? An annoyance, surely. But a minor one on the way to being the best. Getting to the top of your game, being there with the best swimmers in the world, that is what she loved. She loved it so much she couldn't stay away. I remember watching the television coverage of that 50-meter final in 2008. I went back to the footage before Torres and I talked. Torres waits behind the starting blocks, shrugging her broad shoulders and shaking out her long legs. She takes a deep breath and draws up her nearly 6-foot frame, making a determined little wrinkle of her mouth. Her lean, muscled arms tense as she reaches up to adjust her black swim cap, printed with the American flag and Torres in bold white letters. The crowd is cheering madly. She looks down the lane, focusing on its stillness, its clear, rectangular span of water, and cracks her knuckles. Suddenly, she is calm. "I'm ready to go." In the first modern Olympic Games, held in Athens in 1896, after being banned by the Roman Emperor Theodosius I more than 1.5 millennia before as pagan cult worship, The ancient games were originally performed in honor of the gods of Olympus. There was swimming. Four events, four countries: Hungary, Greece, Austria, the United States. On a bright April morning, the swims were held in the brisk waters of the Bay of Zea, just southwest of Athens, on the Piraeus Peninsula. 20,000 spectators were in attendance, including the host country's monarch, King George I. Participants were taken out into the bay by boat. Then they leaped off the vessel and swam furiously back to shore. Back then, freestyle simply meant that you could use whatever stroke you wanted. The United States, so dominant in other sporting disciplines, was shut out of the medal count. By one first-hand account, the American swimmers were blissfully unaware when it came to the realities of the icy Mediterranean Sea in the spring until the crack of the starting pistol. For some, the shock of the cold water brought on a kind of momentary paralysis. The 18-year-old Hungarian swimmer, Alfred Hajós, won both the 100-meter and 1200-meter races. He later told reporters, "My will to live completely overcame my desire to win." Perhaps his is a case in which survival and competition were conflated for a happy end. There were no female competitors. In 1908, the Fédération Internationale de Natation, or FINA, was formed in London during the Olympics to regulate international competition in the sport, with eight founding nations behind it: Great Britain, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Hungary, and Sweden. It still does that job. In Stockholm, 4 years after FINA's founding, women competed in aquatic events in the Olympics for the first time, though not American women. In 1917, in New York City, a court stenographer named Charlotte Eppy Epstein founded the Women's Swimming Association, or WSA. She and a group of fellow secretaries and working women decided that swimming would be a good way to get exercise once they clocked out. In a time when women didn't perform strenuous activities or compete in sports, Epstein was a pioneer. Though she wasn't herself an excellent swimmer, Epstein loved to swim, and she worked tirelessly to establish American women as a force in worldwide competition. The goal dovetailed with her work as a champion of women's rights. She was determined that women be taken seriously as athletes in sport. In one of her signature achievements as the Mother of Women Swimming in America, as she was later dubbed, Epstein persuaded the U.S. Amateur Athletic Union to endorse women's swimming in 1917, the only sport it recognized for female competition that year. At the WSA, Epstein acquired the volunteer coaching services of Lewis Handley, an Italian-born Olympian who used the club as a lab to develop and refine the American crawl. The stroke was revolutionary at the time. It was a variation of the Australian crawl, but with a faster 6-beat flutter kick. Some form of the front crawl has been employed since ancient times, with appearances in Egyptian bas-reliefs from 2000 BC and later, among far-flung indigenous peoples across North America, Brazil, and the Solomon Islands. It's now synonymous with freestyle by default, because of its superior speed. The front crawl is the stroke most people use in competition, if given the choice. Handley taught the American crawl to all the young women at the WSA, including a 12-year-old named Gertrude Ederle. The swimming costumes at the time were literally a drag. Neck-to-toe black wool, which had to be covered with robes when swimmers weren't in the pool. Male swimwear was more progressive. The chief stipulation for men was that their bathing attire be distinguishable from underwear. In 1917, the American Association of Park Superintendents published bathing suit regulations that allowed men to wear tank suits, which consisted of shorts worn with a separate long shirt that covered the groin for modesty's sake. But swimsuits for both genders were evolving rapidly, with less and lighter weight fabric that gave more freedom of movement in the sport. Epstein eventually convinced the governing body to let female swimmers swim without stockings in competition. At the time, this was actually considered nudity. in the one-piece racing suit popularized by the Australian swimming champion Annette Kellerman. Epstein was appointed team manager of the American women's swim team in the 1920 Olympics in Antwerp, and Handley assumed coaching duties. It was the first time American women swimmers were allowed to compete, and Epstein played a critical role in making that happen. WSA swimmer Ethelda Bleibtree dominated at the Antwerp Games, winning gold in all three women's swimming events. Epstein and Handley would continue to work in partnership in subsequent Olympics, paving the way for and training Gertrude Ederle to become one of the best swimmers of all time. Mindful of the example that was made of Epi's girls, especially given the risque association in the public mind with women in bathing suits, Epstein carefully shepherded her swimmers to success both in and out of the water. She made sure they behaved as ladies, had impeccable manners, and dressed well. Ederle was Epstein's ultimate success story. Between 1921 and 1925, Ederle held an astounding 29 national and world amateur swimming records, setting those records in an unprecedented range of distances and conditions, from sprints in a pool to miles-long open water races, and became one of the era's most beloved sports heroes. As Glenn Stout notes in his biography of Ederle, Young Woman and the Sea, Ederle sets world record became as common a headline in the sports pages as Ruth hits home run. During the 1924 Summer Olympics in Paris, Ederle won three medals, one gold and two bronze, despite adverse conditions. An injured knee, and the fact that the women's team had to travel 5 to 6 hours a day just to practice in the Olympic competition pool. American officials didn't want the impressionable young women to mingle with Parisians of questionable morality, hence the exile to the outskirts of Paris. Disappointed with her performance at the Olympics, Ederle set her sights on being the first woman to swim the English Channel. A swim crossing in the frigid, forbidding strait, often chopped by waves and wind, was considered a monumental physical feat during that era. In 1925, Ederle and Epstein traveled to England for Ederle's first attempt. She was disqualified when their British guide, thinking she was drowning, touched her halfway through the swim. A frustrated Ederle later said she was just resting. In the most epic of comebacks, Ederle returned the next year and smashed the men's record by 2 hours. Lloyd's of London took bets on Ederle, laying 5-1 odds against her making it across. Ederle's father, Henry, collected handsomely. She came home to New York and was greeted by a blizzard of ticker tape. Charlotte Epstein eventually led her swimmers to more than 50 world records. Through the next decade and beyond, the New York Times wrote frequently about the Women's Swimming Association's Girls Swim Stars, whose monopoly on various swimming championships during the period was unparalleled. So many local mermaids had been turned out by the club that it was almost old news when a speedy new naiad was introduced to the paper's pages as a coming Ederle. Dara Torres first broke the 50-meter freestyle world record as a 14-year-old back in 1982, the very picture of a speedy new naiad. She swam in the 1984 and 1988 Olympics, winning relay gold, silver, and bronze, and retired after college thinking that was that. At that point in my life, I was considered old, she says. She was barely in her 20s. But like Ederle, Torres wasn't totally happy with her performance at those early Olympics. She hadn't yet won an individual medal. Looking to get into television, she took a menial job as an intern at NBC Sports. One day, she was logging tape. The venerable figure skater Brian Boitano was talking about making a comeback and what it would mean to him to do it. A bell went off in her head. I want to do that. 11 months before the 1992 U.S. Olympic trials, she moved to Florida to train. Torres was elected a team captain of the 1992 delegation to Barcelona and won another relay gold. I was the oldest woman on the team, at 25, she remembers. They called me Granny. She retired again and didn't get in the pool for 7 years. In the spring of 1999, at the coaxing of her friends and her mother, she unretired for the second time, training for the Sydney Olympics in 2000 and winning 5 medals, 3 of them individual this time. When she was walking out of the arena after her final event, a reporter stopped her for an interview. "You didn't swim for 7 years before this," he said. "Do you think you'll be back at 41? "I was like, yeah, right," she says. She went home and retired a third time, at 33, thinking that she had nothing left to prove. That reporter showed himself to be prescient. In 2008, at 41, nearly 2.5 decades after her first Olympic medal, Torres was back in the pool. She took up swimming during pregnancy, in an attempt to get exercise while coping with nausea, and despite her burgeoning belly and the near-constant urge to throw up, she found herself unable to resist racing the middle-aged man in the next lane. It drove her crazy not to beat him. And that's when she began to suspect she was ready for yet another comeback. But it happened more quickly than she expected. A few months after her daughter was born, she surprised herself by swimming well enough to qualify for the 2008 U.S. Olympic trials. Competition kept coaxing her back to the edge of the precipice, as Edgar Allan Poe called it. This time, the precipice was lane 4. Lane 4. We're back with Torres at the starting blocks of that 50-meter freestyle final in Beijing. The swimmers step up, shaking out limbs one more time as they listen for the race official's voice. Swimmers, take your mark. At the beep, they fly off the blocks with a mid-air undulation that propels each of them into the pool. True to its splash and dash nickname, the 50-meter free is a frantic, foamy blur. In this case, it's one that lasts 24 seconds. In basketball, that interval is the shot clock. An NFL player can run the length of the field for a touchdown with an eternity left over to do a funny dance. The International Space Station can travel 120 miles. 24 seconds is time enough to eat a donut, heat up coffee that's gone cold, compose a birthday text to a friend. But in the pool, all you see is 8 lanes of a barely contained tempest churning up bubbles from one end to the other. In that race in Beijing, Torres held the lead from the start, her powerful arms turning over at a relatively controlled and efficient stroke rate. In the final push, her fingertips appeared to be the first to reach for the wall. In the slowed-down underwater footage, though, lane 3, Britta Steffen of Germany comes in strong on Torres's left. As Torres glides in, Steffen's hand surges just past 24.06 seconds. Torres's time? 24.07 seconds. Steffen won gold by 1/100 of a second. 1/100 of a second. It's less than a flap of a hummingbird's wing. Less than the blink of an eye. Torres remembers being in the pool, dumbstruck. No matter the result, she wanted to be respectful, so she ducked under the lane lines to congratulate Steffen on the gold and Campbell on the bronze. As she went underwater, though, expletives and questions rattled around in her head. 1/100 of a second? What did I do? I'm going to be thinking about this for the rest of my life. How could I have done this better? 1/100? She called her personal coach, Michael Loberg, who was watching from a hospital bed in Maryland where he was receiving treatment for a blood disorder, and asked him what she did wrong. "You didn't touch the pad hard enough," he said. 2 minutes after picking up her silver at the 50-meter medal ceremony, she was back on deck again to swim the anchor freestyle leg of the 4x100-meter medley relay. In that race, she swam the fastest 100-meter freestyle split in relay history. She hit the touchpad on the finish so hard that she tore a ligament and broke her thumb. They won silver. More than she likes to win, Torres hates to lose. I ask her how she recovered from the 1/100 of a second heartbreak. "It did stay with me for a while," she admits thoughtfully. "I had to come to terms with it after going over it so many times in my head, that the race was a perfect race for me. I had to be okay with it. I was mature enough, at 41, not to dwell on 1/100 of a second. She realized she could lose a race and still have it be a perfect swim. 12. How to swim like an assassin. In the sporting world, swim meets are a hybrid, individual events scored as team competition, which means that though you contribute to your team's victory or defeat, the experience of a race is a lonely one. Even in a relay event, your particular sliver of team competition is conducted in solitude. Hit the water, and all the sound and fury of the crowd is stripped away. You are swimming in a kind of sensory isolation. Peripheral vision limited by your goggles, or perhaps by the glare of the sun. In your haste to get to the other end of the pool and back, and hand off to the next swimmer if it's a relay race, there is first and foremost your own brain to contend with. A track or cycling or gymnastics meet is similar in format. Everyone ostensibly working in symphony, but the swim meet's aquatic environment enhances the athlete's solo to the extreme. The view from within is